The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie, Chapter 34. The Blue Train Again. The Millionaire's Train, as it's sometimes called, swung round a curve of line at what seemed a dangerous speed. Fenalden, Knighton, and Poirot sat together in silence. Knighton and Fenalden had two compartments connecting with each other, as Ruth Kettering and her maid had on the fateful journey. Poirot's own compartment was farther along the coach. The journey was a painful one for Fenalden, recalling as it did the most agonizing memories. Poirot and Knighton conversed occasionally in low tones without disturbing him. When, however, the train had completed its slow journey round the Ceinture and reached the Gare de Lyon, Poirot became suddenly galvanized into activity. Fenalden realized that part of his object in traveling by the train had been to attempt to reconstruct the crime. Poirot himself acted every part. He was in turn the maid, hurriedly shut into her own compartment. Mrs. Kettering, recognizing her husband with surprise and a trace of anxiety, and Derek Kettering, discovering that his wife was traveling on the train. He tested various possibilities, such as the best way for a person to conceal himself in the second compartment. Then suddenly, an idea seemed to strike him. He clutched at Van Alden's arm. "Mon Dieu, but this is something I have not thought of. We must break our journey in Paris. Quick, quick, let us alight at once." Seizing suitcases, he hurried from the train. Fenalden and Knighton, bewildered but obedient, followed him. Fenalden, having once more formed his opinion of Poirot's ability, was slow to depart from it. At the barrier, they were held up. Their tickets were in the charge of the conductor of the train, a fact which all three of them had forgotten. Poirot's explanations were rapid, fluent, and impassioned, but they produced no effect upon the stolid-faced official. "Let us get quit of this," said Fenalden abruptly. "I gather you're in a hurry, Monsieur Poirot. For God's sake, pay the fares from Calais and let us get right on with whatever you've got in mind." But Poirot's flood of language had suddenly stopped dead, and he had the appearance of a man turned to stone. His arm, still outflung in an impassioned gesture, remained there as though stricken with paralysis. "I have been an imbecile," he said simply. "Ma foi, I lose my head nowadays. Let us return and continue our journey quietly. With reasonable luck, the train will not have gone." They were only just in time, the train moving off as Knighton, the last of the three, swung himself and his suitcase on board. The conductor remonstrated with them feelingly and assisted them to carry their luggage back to their compartments. Fenalden said nothing, but he was clearly disgusted at Poirot's extraordinary conduct. Alone with Knighton for a moment or two, he remarked, "This is a wild goose chase. The man has lost his grip on things. He's got brains up to a point, but any man who loses his head and scuttles around like a frightened rabbit is no earthly darn good." Poirot came to them in a moment or two, full of abject apologies and clearly so crestfallen that harsh words would have been superfluous. Fenalden received his apologies gravely, but managed to restrain himself from making acid comments. They had dinner on the train, and afterwards, somewhat to the surprise of the other two, Poirot suggested that they should all three sit up in Fenalden's compartment. The millionaire looked at him curiously. "Is there anything that you're keeping back from us, Monsieur Poirot?" "I?" Poirot opened his eyes in innocent surprise. "But what an idea!" Fenalden didn't answer, but he was not satisfied. The conductor was told that he need not make up the beds. Any surprise he might have felt was obliterated by the largeness of the tip which Fenalden handed to him. The three men sat in silence. Poirot fidgeted and seemed restless. Presently, he turned to the secretary. "Major Knighton, is the door of your compartment bolted? The door into the corridor, I mean." "Yes, I bolted it myself just now." "Are you sure?" said Poirot. "I'll go and make sure if you like," said Knighton, smiling. No, do not derange yourself. I will see for myself." He passed through the connecting door and returned in a second or two, nodding his head. Yes, it is as you said. You pardon an old man's fussy ways." He closed the connecting door and resumed his place in the right-hand corner. The hours passed. The three men dozed fitfully, waking with uncomfortable starts. Probably never before had three people booked berths on the most luxurious train available, then declined to avail themselves of the accommodation they had paid for. Every now and then Poirot glanced at his watch, and then nodded his head and composed himself to slumber once more. On one occasion he rose from his seat and opened the connecting door, peered sharply into the adjoining compartment, and then returned to his seat, shaking his head. "What's the matter?" whispered Knighton. "You're expecting something to happen, aren't you?"
"I have the nerves," confessed Poirot. "I'm like the cat upon the hot tiles. Every little noise makes me jump."
Knighton yawned. "Of all the darned uncomfortable journeys," he murmured. "I suppose you know what you're playing at, Monsieur Poirot." He composed himself to sleep as best he could. Both he and Fenalden had succumbed to slumber when Poirot, glancing for the 14th time at his watch, leant across and tapped the millionaire on the shoulder. "Eh? What is it?"
"In 5 or 10 minutes, monsieur, we shall arrive at Lyon."
"My God!" Van Alden's face looked white and haggard in the dim light. "Then it must have been about this time that poor Ruth was killed."
He sat staring straight in front of him. His lips twitched a little, his mind reverting back to the terrible tragedy that had saddened his life. There was the usual long, screaming sigh of the brake, and then the train slackened speed and drew into Lyon. Fenalden let down the window and leant out.
"If it wasn't Derrick, if your new theory is correct, it's here that the man left the train?" he asked over his shoulder. Rather to his surprise, Poirot shook his head.
"No," he said thoughtfully, "no man left the train, but I think... yes, I think a woman may have done so."
Knighton gave a gasp. "A woman?" demanded Fenalden sharply.
"Yes, a woman," said Poirot, nodding his head.
"You may not remember, Monsieur Fenalden, but Miss Gray, in her evidence, mentioned that a youth in a cap and overcoat descended onto the platform ostensibly to stretch his legs. Me, I think that youth was most probably a woman."
"But who was she?"
Fenalden's face expressed incredulity, but Poirot replied seriously and categorically. "Her name, or the name under which she was known for many years, is Kitty Kidd. But you, Monsieur Fenalden, knew her by another name, that of Ada Mason."
Knighton sprang to his feet.
"What?" he cried. Poirot swung round to him. "Ah! Before I forget it," he whipped something from a pocket and held it out. "Permit me to offer you a cigarette, out of your own cigarette case. It was careless of you to drop it when you boarded the train on the Ceinture at Paris."
Knighton stood staring at him as though stupefied.
Then he made a movement, but Poirot flung up his hand in a warning gesture.
"No, don't move," he said in a silky voice. "The door into the next compartment is open, and you're being covered from there this minute. I unbolted the door into the corridor when we left Paris, and our friends the police were told to take their places there. As I expect you know, the French police want you rather urgently, Major Knighton, or shall we say, Monsieur le Marquis."
Chapter 35. Explanations.
Explanations?
Poirot smiled. He was sitting opposite the millionaire at a luncheon table in the latter's private suite at the Negresco. Facing him was a relieved but very puzzled man. Poirot leant back in his chair, lit one of his tiny cigarettes, and stared reflectively at the ceiling.
"Yes, I will give you explanations. It began with the one point that puzzled me. You know what that point was? The disfigured face. It is not an uncommon thing to find when investigating a crime and it rouses an immediate question, the question of identity. That naturally was the first thing that occurred to me. Was the dead woman really Mrs. Kettering? But that line led me nowhere, for Miss Gray's evidence was positive and very reliable, so I put that idea aside. The dead woman was Ruth Kettering. When did you first begin to suspect the maid? Not for some time, but one particular little point drew my attention to her. The cigarette case found in the railway carriage, and which she told us was one which Mrs. Kettering had given to her husband. Now that was, on the face of it, most improbable, seeing the terms they were on. It awakened a doubt in my mind as to the general veracity of Ada Mason's statements. There was the rather suspicious fact to be taken into consideration that she'd only been with her mistress for 2 months. Certainly, it did not seem as if she could have had anything to do with the crime, since she'd been left behind in Paris, and Mrs. Kettering had been seen alive by several people afterwards. But, Poirot leaned forward. He raised an emphatic forefinger and wagged it with intense emphasis at Fenalden. But I am a good detective. I suspect. There's nobody and nothing that I do not suspect. I believe nothing that I am told. I say to myself, how do we know that Ada Mason was left behind in Paris? And at first, the answer to that question seemed completely satisfactory. There was the evidence of your secretary, Major Knighton, a complete outsider whose testimony might be supposed to be entirely impartial, and there was the dead woman's own words to the conductor of the train. But I put the latter point aside for the moment, because a very curious idea, an idea perhaps fantastic and impossible, was growing up in my mind. If by any outside chance it happened to be true, that particular piece of testimony was worthless. I concentrated on the chief stumbling block to my theory, Major Knighton's statement that he saw Ada Mason at the Ritz after the blue train had left Paris. That seemed conclusive enough, but yet, on examining the facts carefully, I noted two things. First, that by a curious coincidence he, too, had been exactly 2 months in your service. Secondly, his initial letter was the same, K. Supposing, that it was his cigarette case which had been found in the carriage. Then, if Ada Mason and he were working together, and she recognized it when we showed it to her, would she not act precisely as she had done? At first, taken aback, she quickly evolved a plausible theory that would agree with Mr. Kettering's guilt. Bien entendu, that was not the original idea. The Comte de la Roche was to be the scapegoat, though Ada Mason would not make her recognition of him too certain in case he should be able to prove an alibi. Now, if you'll cast your mind back to that time, you'll remember a significant thing that happened. I suggested to Ada Mason that the man she'd seen was not the Comte de la Roche, but Derek Kettering. She seemed uncertain at the time, but after I had got back to my hotel, you rang me up and told me that she'd come to you and said that, on thinking it over, she was now quite convinced that the man in question was Mr. Kettering. I'd been expecting something of the kind. There could be but one explanation of this sudden certainty on her part. After leaving your hotel, she'd had time to consult with somebody, and had received instructions which she acted upon. Who had given her these instructions? Major Knighton. And there was another very small point, which might mean nothing or might mean a great deal. In casual conversation, Knighton had talked of a jewel robbery in Yorkshire in a house where he was staying. Perhaps a mere coincidence, perhaps another small link in the chain. But there's one thing I don't understand, Monsieur Poirot. I guess I must be dense, or I would have seen it before now. Who was the man in the train at Paris? Derek Kettering or the Comte de la Roche? That's the simplicity of the whole thing. There was no man. Ah, mille tonnerres! Do you not see the cleverness of it all? Whose word have we for it that there was ever a man there? Only Ada Mason's. And we believe in Ada Mason because of Knighton's evidence that she was left behind in Paris. But Ruth herself told the conductor that she'd left her maid behind there, demurred Van Alden. Ah, I'm coming to that. We have Mrs. Kettering's own evidence there, but on the other hand, we've not really got her evidence because, Monsieur Van Alden, a dead woman cannot give evidence. It is not her evidence, but the evidence of the conductor of the train, a very different affair altogether. So you think the man was lying? No, no, not at all. He spoke what he thought to be the truth, but the woman who told him that she'd left her maid in Paris was not Mrs. Kettering. Van Alden stared at him. Monsieur Van Alden, Ruth Kettering was dead before the train arrived at the Gare de Lyon. It was Ada Mason, dressed in her mistress's very distinctive clothing, who purchased a dinner basket and who made that very necessary statement to the conductor. Impossible! No, no, Monsieur Van Alden, not impossible. Les femmes, they look so much alike nowadays that one identifies them more by their clothing than by their faces. Ada Mason was the same height as your daughter, dressed in that very sumptuous fur coat and the little red lacquer hat jammed down over her eyes, with just a bunch of auburn curls showing over each ear. It was no wonder that the conductor was deceived. He'd not previously spoken to Mrs. Kettering, you remember. True, he'd seen the maid just for a moment when she handed him the tickets, but his impression had been merely that of a gaunt, black-clad female. If he'd been an unusually intelligent man, he might have gone so far as to say that mistress and maid were not unlike, but it's extremely unlikely that he would even think that. And remember, Ada Mason, or Kitty Kidd, was an actress, able to change her appearance and tone of voice at a moment's notice. No, no, there was no danger of his recognizing the maid in the mistress's clothing, but there was the danger that when he came to discover the body, he might realize it was not the woman he'd talked to the night before. And now we see the reason for the disfigured face. The chief danger that Ada Mason ran was that Catherine Gray might visit her compartment after the train left Paris, and she provided against that difficulty by ordering a dinner basket and by locking herself in her compartment. But who killed Ruth, and when? First, bear it in mind that the crime was planned and undertaken by the two of them, Knighton and Ada Mason, working together. Knighton was in Paris that day on your business. He boarded the train somewhere on its way around the Ceinture. Mrs. Kettering would be surprised, but she would be quite unsuspicious. Perhaps he draws her attention to something out of the window, and as she turns to look, he slips the cord round her neck, and the whole thing is over in a second or two. The door of the compartment is locked, and he and Ada Mason set to work. They strip off the dead woman's outer clothes. Mason and Knighton roll the body up in a rug and put it on the seat in the adjoining compartment amongst the bags and suitcases. Knighton drops off the train, taking the jewel case containing the rubies with him. Since the crime is not supposed to have been committed until nearly 12 hours later, he's perfectly safe, and his evidence and the supposed Mrs. Kettering's words to the conductor will provide a perfect alibi for his accomplice. At the Gare de Lyon, Ada Mason gets a dinner basket, and shutting herself into the toilet compartment, she quickly changes into her mistress's clothes, adjusts two false bunches of auburn curls, and generally makes up to resemble her as closely as possible. When the conductor comes to make up the bed, she tells him the prepared story about having left her maid behind in Paris, and while he's making up the berth, she stands looking out the window so that her back is towards the corridor and people passing along there. That was a wise precaution because, as we know, Miss Gray was one of those passing, and she, among others, was willing to swear that Mrs. Kettering was still alive at that hour. "Go on," said Van Alden. Before getting to Lyon, Ada Mason arranged her mistress's body in the bunk, folded up the dead woman's clothes neatly on the end of it, and herself changed into a man's clothes and prepared to leave the train. When Derek Kettering entered his wife's compartment, and as he thought, saw her asleep in her berth, the scene had been set, and Ada Mason was hidden in the next compartment waiting for the moment to leave the train unobserved. As soon as the conductor had swung himself down to the platform at Lyon, she follows, slouching along as though just taking a breath of air. At a moment when she's unobserved, she hurriedly crosses to the other platform and takes the first train back to Paris and the Ritz Hotel. Her name has been registered there as taking a room the night before by one of Knighton's female accomplices. She has nothing to do but wait there placidly for your arrival. The jewels are not, and never have been, in her possession. No suspicion attaches to him, and as your secretary, he brings them to Nice without the least fear of discovery. Their delivery there to Monsieur Papopoulos is already arranged for, and they're entrusted to Mason at the last moment to hand over to the Greek. Altogether a very neatly planned coup, as one would expect from a master of the game, such as the Marquis. And you honestly mean that Richard Knighton is a well-known criminal who's been at this business for years? Poirot nodded. One of the chief assets of the gentleman called the Marquis was his plausible, ingratiating manner. You fell a victim of his charm, Monsieur Fenalden, when you engaged him as a secretary on such a slight acquaintanceship. I could have sworn that he never angled for the post, cried the millionaire. It was very astutely done. So astutely done that it deceived a man whose knowledge of other men is as great as yours is. I looked up his antecedents, too. The fellow's record was excellent. Yes, yes, that was part of the game. As Richard Knighton, his life was quite free from reproach. He was well-born, well-connected, did honorable service in the war, and seemed altogether above suspicion. But when I came to glean information about the mysterious Marquis, I found many points of similarity. Knighton spoke French like a Frenchman. He'd been in America, France, and England at much the same time as the Marquis was operating. The Marquis was last heard of as engineering various jewel robberies in Switzerland, and it was in Switzerland that you'd come across Major Knighton. And it was at precisely that time that the first rumors were going round of your being in treaty for the famous rubies. But why murder? Murmured Fenalden brokenly. Surely a clever thief could have stolen the jewels without running his head into a noose. Poirot shook his head. This is not the first murder that lies to the Marquis's charge. He's a killer by instinct. He believes, too, in leaving no evidence behind him. Dead men and women tell no tales. The Marquis had an intense passion for famous and historical jewels. He laid his plans far beforehand by installing himself as your secretary and getting his accomplice to obtain the situation of maid with your daughter, for whom he guessed the jewels were destined. And though this was his matured and carefully thought-out plan, he didn't scruple to attempt a shortcut by hiring a couple of Apaches to waylay you in Paris on the night you bought the jewels. The plan failed, which hardly surprised him, I think. This plan was, so he thought, completely safe. No possible suspicion could attach to Richard Knighton. But like all great men, and the Marquis was a great man, he had his weaknesses. He fell genuinely in love with Miss Gray, and suspecting her liking for Derek Kettering, he could not resist the temptation to saddle him with the crime when the opportunity presented itself. And now, Monsieur Fenalden, I'm going to tell you something very curious. Miss Gray is not a fanciful woman by any means, yet she firmly believes that she felt your daughter's presence beside her one day in the casino gardens at Monte Carlo, just after she'd been having a long talk with Knighton. She was convinced, she says, that the dead woman was urgently trying to tell her something, and it suddenly came to her that what the dead woman was trying to say was that Knighton was her murderer. The idea seemed so fantastic at the time that Miss Gray spoke of it to no one. But she was so convinced of its truth that she acted on it, wild as it seemed. She did not discourage Knighton's advances, and she pretended to him that she was convinced of Derek Kettering's guilt.
"Extraordinary," said Fenalden.
"Yes, it is very strange. One cannot explain these things. Oh, by the way, there is one little point that baffled me considerably. Your secretary has a decided limp, the result of a wound that he received in the war. Now, the Marquis most decidedly did not limp. That was a stumbling block. But Miss Lennox Tamplin happened to mention one day that Knighton's limp had been a surprise to the surgeon who'd been in charge of the case in her mother's hospital. That suggested camouflage. When I was in London, I went to the surgeon in question, and I got several technical details from him which confirmed me in that belief. I mentioned the name of that surgeon in Knighton's hearing the day before yesterday. The natural thing would have been for Knighton to mention that he had been attended by him during the war, but he said nothing. And that little point, if nothing else, gave me the last final assurance that my theory of the crime was correct. Miss Gray, too, provided me with a cutting, showing that there had been a robbery at Lady Tamplin's hospital during the time that Knighton had been there. She realized that I was on the same track as herself when I wrote to her from the Ritz in Paris. I had some trouble in my inquiries there, but I got what I wanted. Evidence that Ada Mason arrived on the morning after the crime and not on the evening of the day before. There was a long silence. Then the millionaire stretched out a hand to Poirot across the table. "I guess you know what this means to me, Monsieur Poirot," he said huskily. "I'm sending you round a check in the morning, but no check in the world will express what I feel about what you've done for me. You're the goods, Monsieur Poirot. Every time, you are the goods." Poirot rose to his feet. His chest swelled. "I am only a Hercule Poirot," he said modestly. "Yet, as you say, in my own way I am a big man, even as you also are a big man. I'm glad and happy to have been of service to you. Now I go to repair the damages caused by travel. Alas, my excellent Georges is not with me." In the lounge of the hotel he encountered a friend, the venerable Monsieur Papopoulos, his daughter Zia beside him. "I thought you'd left Nice, Monsieur Poirot," murmured the Greek, as he took the detective's affectionately proffered hand. "Business compelled me to return, my dear Monsieur Papopoulos."
"Business?"
"Yes, business. And talking of business, I hope your health is better, my dear friend."
"Much better. In fact, we're returning to Paris tomorrow."
"I'm enchanted to hear such good news. You've not completely ruined the Greek ex-minister, I hope."
I understand you sold him a very wonderful ruby, which, strictly entre nous, is being worn by Mademoiselle Morel, the dancer."
"Yes," murmured Monsieur Papopoulos. "Yes, that is so.
A ruby not unlike the famous Heart of Fire."
"It has points of resemblance, certainly," said the Greek casually. "You have a wonderful hand with jewels, Monsieur Papopoulos. I congratulate you. Mademoiselle Zia, I am desolate that you are returning to Paris so speedily. I had hoped to see some more of you now that my business is accomplished."
"Would one be indiscreet if one asked what that business was?" asks Monsieur Papopoulos.
"Not at all, not at all. I have just succeeded in laying the Marquis by the heels."
A faraway look came over Monsieur Papopoulos's noble countenance.
"The Marquis," he murmured. "Now why does that seem familiar to me?"
"No, I cannot recall it."
"You would not, I'm sure," said Poirot. "I refer to a very notable criminal and jewel robber. He's just been arrested for the murder of the English lady, Madame Kettering."
"Indeed! How interesting these things are!"
A polite exchange of farewells followed, and when Poirot was out of earshot, Monsieur Papopoulos turned to his daughter.
"Zia," he said with feeling, "that man is the devil."
"I like him."
"I like him myself," admitted Monsieur Papopoulos, "but he's the devil all the same."
Chapter 36. By the Sea.
The mimosa was nearly over. The scent of it in the air was faintly unpleasant. There were pink geraniums twining along the balustrade of Lady Tamplin's villa, and masses of carnations below sent up a sweet, heavy perfume. The Mediterranean was at its bluest. Poirot sat on the terrace with Lennox Tamplin. He had just finished telling her the same story that he'd told to Van Alden 2 days before. Lennox had listened to him with absorbed attention, her brows knitted and her eyes somber. When he'd finished, she said simply, "And Derek? He was released yesterday. And he has gone where? He left Nice last night.
For St. Mary Mead?"
"Yes, for St. Mary Mead." There was a pause. "I was wrong about Catherine," said Lennox. "I thought she didn't care." "She's very reserved. She trusts no one."
"She might have trusted me," said Lennox, with a shade of bitterness.
"Yes," said Poirot gravely, "she might have trusted you, but Mademoiselle Catherine has spent a great deal of her life listening, and those who have listened do not find it easy to talk. They keep their sorrows and joys to themselves and tell no one."
"I was a fool," said Lennox. "I thought she really cared for Knight, and I ought to have known better. I suppose I thought so because, well, I hoped so."
Poirot took her hand and gave it a little friendly squeeze.
"Courage, mademoiselle," he said gently.
Lennox looked very straight out across the sea, and her face, in its ugly rigidity, had for the moment a tragic beauty.
"Oh, well," she said at last, "it would not have done. I'm too young for Derek. He's like a kid that's never grown up. He wants the Madonna touch."
There was a long silence. Then Lennox turned to him quickly and impulsively.
"But I did help, Monsieur Poirot. At any rate, I did help."
"Yes, mademoiselle. It was you who gave me the first inkling of the truth when you said that the person who committed the crime need not have been on the train at all. Before that, I could not see how the thing had been done."
Lennox drew a deep breath.
"I'm glad," she said. "At any rate, that is something." From far behind them, there came a long, drawn-out scream of an engine's whistle.
"That's that damn blue train," said Lennox. "Trains are relentless things, aren't they, Monsieur Poirot? People are murdered and die, but they go on just the same.
I'm talking nonsense, but you know what I mean."
"Yes, yes, I do know. Life is like a train, mademoiselle. It goes on, and it's a good thing that that is so."
"Why?"
"Because the train gets to its journey's end at last, and there's a proverb about that in your language, mademoiselle."
"Journey's end in lovers' meeting," Lennox laughed.
"That's not going to be true for me."
"Yes. Yes, it is true. You are young, younger than you yourself know. Trust the train, mademoiselle, for it is le bon Dieu who drives it."
The whistle of the engine came again.
"Trust the train, mademoiselle," murmured Poirot again.
"And trust Hercule Poirot. He knows."